netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This episode is brought to you by the new October term, open now at fxphd.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. We produce several podcasts, but this FX podcast is where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. This podcast is your opportunity to hear directly from the source, from the front lines of visual effects. Be sure to check out all of our other podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. Today, Mike Seymour will speak with Florian Gellinger from RiseFX about the film Cloud Atlas. RiseFX was one of several vendors on the film, and their LiDAR scanning company, Point Cloud 9, also did LiDAR services on the film. Before we get to that, if you're a regular listener to this podcast, you might guess that in this slot I do a promo for either fxphd.com, our online training site, or some special event we're working on. Well, I want to mention FXPhd to you, but not any specific thing. By day, I'm a Flame Nuke Hero user, so I tend to focus on classes related to what I do. With Smoke on the Mac coming out soon, we're up to preview release 5 as I record this. I just haven't had a chance to really dig into the whole Smoke release, so I downloaded Smoke version 5, the preview release, and the Smoke Fast Forward classes, as well as the last term Smoke classes. Anyway, just kind of a jump start, and I got to tell you, as a long-term Flame user, I just got to say, I just love taking the classes and seeing how other people work, because I always learn something. I always find some button, some trick, some technique that, you know, you get focused in your day-to-day life and you just think, I know everything, or, you know, I have it down. I know what I need. I know how I need to do everything I need to do on this box. And then you sit down, you take a class, and you just go, wow, that's a different way of doing that. And I'm going to try that because I really like that better. So anyway, just kind of a different focus on the whole class thing. You know, we often talk about taking your career to the next level and taking your, you know, learning something that maybe is not your thing. You're a roto person. You want to take a tracking class or something like that. But, you know, I've just been finding it great to take classes that are directly in my wheelhouse and picking up little tips and tricks along the way. Anyway, let's jump now into Mike Seymour speaking with Florian Gellinger from RiseFX about Cloud Atlas.
Florian, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it. How are you, sir?
I'm very well. Thank you, Mike. How are you?
Good. So I spoke to you a while ago when you were actually, I think, in the midst of doing a bunch of scanning for a little independent film for a couple of filmmakers, Cloud Atlas. And that's turned out to be pretty good, actually. How's that been working for you?
Well, very well. Yes, we've been working for Dan Glass and the Wachowskis and Tom Tykwer for the last 12 months, pretty much, from previous stage to LiDAR scanning on set, set supervision as well, and then, of course, the work in post started this year in January.
So let's break that down, because in all seriousness, you've had a lot of involvement and at different levels. It's a bit different to a normal vendor relationship because of this pre-production and LiDAR scanning. So when did you first get involved? And explain to me the two companies at your end that are involved.
Well, we got involved pretty early on. I met Dan Glass at the FMX conference last year in Stuttgart, and I showed him some stuff that we did for Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. And the moment he set foot on German soil and got to Berlin for prepping Cloud Atlas, he gave me a call, and he said that he needed an additional artist for doing previs out on the studio lot in Babelsberg. So we shipped one of our best 3D artists to his office to work at his liking, and in the end he liked his work that much that we provided the visual effects for the entire sequence based in the 70s in the Bay Area somewhere with Halle Berry playing the lead role, and also right after previous phase was over and we started shooting, I was there on set, and also we provided LiDAR scanning with our sister company, Point Cloud 9, for the entire shoot. We scanned sets, we scanned props and vehicles, and also because the device is so portable, we took it to Glasgow and Edinburgh with us to Scotland, and scanned a couple of streets and vintage cars that we had on location.
So let's discuss the LiDAR scanning before we come back to the visual effects for a second, because you, the company did not just sort of marginal LiDAR scanning of sets, but there were some incredibly long and large LiDAR scans that you guys provided in terms of point clouds.
True, yeah. We had a couple of streets in Glasgow that had to be reconfigured to look like San Francisco. So basically what we did was we scanned those this whole block, or I think it was about two blocks of streets in Glasgow, and then dressed everything with digital props like telegraph poles and typical San Francisco houses that would just perfectly intersect with where the ground was in our LiDAR scan, so that we had a perfect mat line, and we just had to track our cameras into our LiDAR scan and match move that to the plate that production gave us to work on, and just rendered the houses and telegraph poles, and we pretty much had the whole street dressed with just one lighting setup and comped everything in. On the other hand, of course, there was a lot of set construction going on the studio lot in Babelsberg in Berlin, where we scanned not only the set pieces to provide that for all the other vendors, like ILM and Method. We also scanned vehicles, like there's this futuristic skiff bike chase that ILM has taken care of. We scanned the vehicles for that, and well, just, you know, everything that helps to populate backgrounds with just simple geometry.
It's a very complex film, and if people aren't aware, it's not exactly a major Hollywood studio film in the sense that it's been distributed by Warners, and the Wachowskis are obviously incredibly accomplished filmmakers from The Matrix, but in fact you're kind of operating a bit outside the system, weren't you? So there must have been a bit of a sense of not having an unlimited cash reserves.
True. But I think that Dan Glass had a perfect plan for that. I mean, he distributed the work over a bunch of countries and companies. I mean, the really geometry intense stuff, as I said, was taken care of by ILM, because they're really good at that, handling high poly counts and enormously complex scenes. Because they were so close together, Dan, ILM and Matthews took pretty much care of the whole future episodes. And then there were a couple of companies involved in Germany, of course, part because of the tax incentive that you get when you shoot in Germany. At the same time, I think we came up with a couple of really smart ideas to achieve what we were aiming for with the budget that we had. For example, I think we didn't use motion control cameras any single day on set, and it was pretty much, I mean, everything they shot was pretty much working perfectly in the schedule that they had. Everything that we shot on location in Scotland, for example, we just finished right on time, and that was a blast to see how, for example, when I was joining the Tom Tykwer unit for the 70s episode, how he and his DOP, Frank Grieber, how they were working together as a perfectly adjusted team, and they were just nailing every shot.
Yeah, of course, Dan's an incredibly experienced supervisor, and he's worked together with the Wachowski on several films already, including several of the Matrix films and stuff since then. So they must have had a pretty good working relationship. But this is a film that doesn't have two directors; it effectively has three. So who were you? Were you on set in sections that were being directed by one, two, or all three of the team?
I was on set for the Tückfer episodes, and together with Steph Ceretti from Method London, and Dan was on set for the Wachowski episodes. Although later, during post, we got assigned a couple of shots from the Wachowski episodes as well that just popped up out of nowhere.
So let's discuss that San Francisco sequence that I love so much. It's so strong. It's already become rather iconically associated with the film. It's a car accident, or maybe it's not an accident, that involves a car going off a bridge. Can you describe the shot for us, and then how you guys were involved in actually working on it when it moved from being something that you were involved with in terms of production to actually now Rise Effects doing the visual effects work?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, of course. The during the previous phase, Tom came up with this crazy idea of having a Volkswagen Beetle being pushed off a bridge somewhere in the San Francisco Bay Area, and the movement that the car should make was that it kind of shoots up the railing rather than just dropping down the bridge. And then while shooting up the railing, it should kind of corkscrew and then tumble down into the depth of the water. So we did one exterior shot of that. And then there is this, pretty spectacular interior shot of what's going on, where we are inside the car with Halle Berry, and the car was prepped on the studio lot on the gimbal to turn it upside down 180 degrees. And so you see pretty much nothing but blue screen behind Halle Berry, and suddenly her hair moves up and the car rotates 180 degrees. The thing is that later we then added the car of the villain in the background that shoots straight into the side of her Beetle, and after that you really just see crumbling bits of railing of the bridge and the water beneath her. And as everything, all that is happening, the camera translates behind Halle Berry onto the back seat, looking through the windshield and looking straight at the water surface that's coming towards us.
And not only that, but the water then breaks through that windshield, coming at the camera with a kind of ferocity that is hard to take. Now, the thing that makes this sort of remarkable to me is that there's this real sense of weightlessness that comes when she's in the car. How was that plate shot? How did you achieve that real sense of her being literally kind of... I guess the only word I can describe is weightless as the car is going through the parabolic arc of that rise and then fall.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's pretty much all being done. The problem, of course, is when you have a car on a gimbal and you just flip it upside down, Halle Berry's hair did just what it was supposed to. You could see her hair moving up, and it looked like she was being weightless. She just did an incredible job by just pretending to be weightless. The way she moves her arms and her face, the way she looks scared. But of course, the problem is when you just flip a car upside down, everything that's not fixed inside the car will just drop to the ceiling. I mean, being upside down.
Yeah.
The problem with that was that all those bits and pieces just didn't really belong there. When we first saw the shot in post and tried to figure out how to make this whole move work, so we removed everything that was just plain dropping with 1G inside the car, and replaced everything with CG props that we then fed into a rigid body simulation inside our CG car that we animated to go off the bridge, just to see what the stuff inside the car would be doing. And always when we had the impression that all those bits and pieces just weren't selling the idea of zero gravity enough, we just slowed them down in translation so that you can see a couple of
cups, postcards, a magazine and everything just tumbling slowly through frame while the car is dropping. And I think that's really the thing that sells the zero gravity.
Yeah, I mean, it's a remarkable sequence. But, of course, then there's this glass-breaking aspect. Now, I can imagine that you could deal with the glass-breaking by, you know, comping it in, but also the water rushing in. I assume that's a practical, or did you do a sim on that?
No, that's practical. I mean, there's this whole sequence right after she hits the water surface. We're inside the car with her, underwater, and we created this Houdini environment around the car while it's sinking deeper and deeper in the bay, with bubbles and CG murky water around the car. And then you can see the cracks in all the windows around her building slowly, which are, of course, CG cracks that we built with a spline-based rig in Houdini so that we could just draw the splines wherever we wanted the cracks to build. And then for the final shot, when the windshield breaks, we had a tip tank on the studio lot with a stunt double and sugar glass in the car. And yeah, we just did it. I mean, I honestly didn't think it would be possible, or I thought it would be too dangerous to have a stunt double sitting there in the driver's seat. But they said it's safe, and they did it, and it worked. I mean, we had a perfect Lisa Ray stunt double sitting in the driver's seat. They tipped the tank with I don't know how many gallons of water straight onto the sugar glass windshield going down a slide, and the glass broke. And then all we had to do was pretty much replace everything before the glass breaks with our CG environment on the outside and CG cracks in the windshield with bubbles rising around the car, and then just do a cut onto the broken windshield with the practical water rushing into the car.
You guys only came to Houdini, what, about a year or so ago, if I remember correctly? And I think you're quite happy with it, aren't you, as a tool?
We are very happy with it, yes. Well, the idea came from our time on Captain America, where we had a ridiculously short schedule and we had to do some pretty high complexity shots with people being disintegrated with cloth and smoke and a lot of fluid stuff going on that was supposed to influence the geometry and how it would behave. And one of our heads of 3D, he said that he was very thankful for the experience, but that he wouldn't want to do it again in Maya. And so pretty much straight after May 2011, he was very keen on getting his hands on Houdini and trying it. And so when we got to work on Cloud Atlas, we started doing early tests, he said in November, I've been looking at Houdini for quite a while, and why don't we try it for the heavy sim stuff? I think it's safe to try, and we did, and we never looked back, really.
Was it Houdini that you went to for one of the other shots that I really liked, which was when you got to do an aircraft explosion?
Yes, that, and we did pretty much the whole underwater sequence, the aircraft explosion, and well, as the title suggests, Cloud Atlas, there are some clouds to do in the movie. So also, we used the microvoxel rendering of Mantra in Houdini to create clouds that nicely scatter the sunlight that that hits them. And that worked really, really well. So to say the least, we are very impressed with what it can do, and we'll build in the future on that.
I guess the aircraft explosion, unlike Halle Berry's VW going into the water, was much more just a fully CG shot, wasn't it?
It was, yes.
What did you render that in? Give me the pipeline.
It's all rendered in Mantra. That was pretty much one of my decisions to take from the start. I said that if we were going to use Houdini for the whole underwater stuff and the aircraft explosion, then I insist on having everything rendered from Houdini straight out of the box through its native renderer, because then at least you can erase or get rid of some of the possible, what would you call it? Like the
translation problems?
Yeah, exactly.
Mantra is fairly similar to RenderMan. What's your renderer of choice if you weren't using Houdini? Like, what's your sort of baseline rendering approach there?
So far, we've always worked with either MentalRay or V-Ray.
Right.
It was just depending on the preference of the artist. But was the first time we got our hands on something RenderMan similar. And we are also even considering right now moving completely to Mantra and kind of configuring Houdini to work as our Cortana, but that's a completely different topic.
Well, that's pretty interesting. That's an interesting move because most people use it more as a sort of a specialist renderer, though, as we said, it's a lot like, RenderMan. But that would be a particularly interesting workflow. I've not heard of someone doing that before. Would you be writing special scripts to develop that, or how would you push it make it like a Cortana?
To start from, I think that every implementation of a renderer into a pipeline works better, or you can at least give the artist better tools if you at least have a pretty complete shader library from the start, so that they don't have to create everything themselves by trial and error with a rendering platform that they've never used before. If you can give them something to start with, just standard materials and standard textures, something that we are trying to figure out right now, just as a starting point, I think that adopting a new renderer in the toolkit will be a lot easier from that point on. So yeah, that's what we're trying right now. And then we'll have to figure out how to do the rest, to do the heavy geometry handling and to pipe really heavy scenes through Houdini. But I think that's not going to be a big issue. I mean, the first tests were very promising.
Yeah, I must admit, I'm glad to hear that you're using those microvoxel stuff, because that does produce very good results, doesn't it, for atmospherics and in your case, clouds.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even for the airplane explosion, the whole smoke that's coming out and the fire, the fire's really illuminating the smoke from the inside. And we're even working on another show right now that's using the same technology because we were so impressed by the results. The way you can use actual CG fire to illuminate, it's the smoke it generates from the inside, the way it scatters the light and the way it starts to glow and illuminates its whole environment. I mean, that's really hard to get if you just render the fire and the smoke from Mantra and then move to another renderer to do the environment or the rigid bodies around it. So that was the basic idea. We really wanted to have the full benefit of using CG fire from Houdini and rendering it. So by doing that, we could really use the fire from Houdini to light up the airplane from the inside once the hull breaks and the fire gets out. It illuminates the hull from the outside. When the whole thing breaks apart, the huge explosion, the fireball, as it dissipates into the smoke plume that gets illuminated from the inside from its hot core, you still see that light and the reflection of it spreading on all the different bits and pieces of the rigid body that's flying through the air at about 300 miles per hour. So I'd say that is a quality, especially with the holdouts that you'd had to render with all the bits and pieces. If you were to do the rigid bodies through another renderer, you always get those little jaggy edges from different aliasing and from different motion blur settings if you were to render all the bits and pieces from different renderers. And when you try to comp them together, then you have to take care of the first. So going through one renderer in that case made it really, really, really easy because everything was really consistent. The light was very consistent. We didn't have to bother about fixing any edges of holdout objects in voxel volumes or anything. It just worked straight out of the box. And then we just gave our compositors all the paths that they could possibly want. And that was it. It was pretty much straightforward from that point on.
The other way, I guess, to solve that would be to introduce a deep compositing pipeline that didn't require holdout mats. Is that something that you would do enough of that you would consider a deep compositing pipeline, or is that more, only if you had like a large volumetric show would you bother to go that far?
Well, we had a look at it at the very start, especially for the underwater shots with the Beetle, with the thousands and thousands of little bubbles around the car, and with the murky water, because the murky water was like really super small particles and micro voxels that were then rendered around the bubbles, and we always had to render holdouts for everything. So, of course, yeah, it would have been the best solution to go through deep compositing, but we just couldn't figure out how to make it work with the RAT files that come out of Houdini in the time that we had. So, I mean, of course, that's the next step. We really are very keen on trying deep compositing, especially when Nuke 7 comes out. And we just have to get our whole render pipeline working in that sense so that we get Houdini to give us files that work with Nuke the way they are, because we don't want to go through an extra conversion process after the 3D rendering has finished.
So speaking of rendering, one of the most, I think, just beautiful sequences is the exterior, I think it's the satellite center, the stuff mm-hmm. on top of the... Talk to me about that, because that's obviously there's a tracking issue there and a compositing issue, but it's also such some really fine rendering.
That satellite communication center with this artichoke-like dish that's opening, that's from the futuristic episode of the movie.
Zachary's story.
Exactly. And that is one that was directed by the Wachowskis. And so the satellite communication center, they sent us during the bidding process, they sent us the scribbles and the paintings of the art department that they did during production time. And we just immediately knew that we wanted to do it because the artwork was so amazingly beautiful with like little snow, little bits of snow everywhere on the satellite communication center. I mean, it's really reminiscent of some of the design that ILM and Lucasfilm did on the Star Wars movies. And we were just blown away by the architecture of their artwork. And, we really started off by, having the idea, and that's something that I think is really hard to see. It's like another little Easter egg in the movie. I think that's really hard to see for the normal audience. It's the entrance of the power plant in the 1970s episode with Halle Berry is the same entrance as the satellite communication center has on the mountaintop.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we LiDAR scanned the power plant entrance and then pretty much transformed it into this structure where all the windows that we have in the power plant entrance are covered with concrete tiles. But other than that, the scale and the number of windows and everything is exactly the same, only that it's somewhere on a thousands of meter high mountain top. So that was pretty much our starting point, because that was, I think it was either Dan's or Steph's idea to work with that, or even the art department's. I'm not quite sure anymore. So we started with that, tracking, of course, the camera, the heliplate around the mountain with Halle Berry and Tom Hanks climbing the mountaintop. And there was quite a lot of real clouds covering the mountaintop already. So from what we got from the 3D track, we projected as many prediction points back onto the mountain in Nuke, generating a point cloud for our 3D track. Went through the point cloud generation tool that then gives us a really, really dense 3D point prediction cloud for our plate in relation to the camera, and then we took that whole point cloud into our LiDAR meshing pipeline, because everything we get out of our LiDAR scanner is pretty much the same thing. I mean, it's just points in 3D space. So yep. We took that into the normal tool set that we use for our LiDAR scans to mesh them, and generated the mountaintop out of all the various camera angles one by one, aligned them, and then made sure that we pretty much had, for all of the shots, the mountaintop covered in terms of geometry for every angle that we have to cover in the movie. And from that point on, everything was fairly easy from a match move point, because we really had just the geometry of the mountaintop in Maya and started building our satellite communication center on top of that. Based on the artwork, a couple of things was our idea. For example, the way that the artichoke tilts is in our design based on wires that pull it up on a sled on a couple of arc rails and stuff like that. But it's pretty true to the original concept. Of course, without snow-covered mountain, because on Mallorca they didn't get that in the heliplate. But then when we finished that and had the whole rotten architecture with like the crumbling concrete foundation and grass growing everywhere in every little crack and in every little gap that built over time, then we started dressing everything around it, like regenerating the clouds that were around it in Udine with macrovoxel clouds and lighting them with the sun. And see, that's what I was referring to earlier with rendering holdouts in one renderer and then rigid bodies in the other one. We rendered the whole satellite communication center through Mental Ray and Maya, and then took the geometry through Alembic files into Udine and used that as a holder for the clouds that we were moving around the satellite communication center. And while it worked okay, I wouldn't say that it worked great. And there was still some stuff to fix, and like the seams and the edges everywhere where the white clouds would move around a dark edge of the building. That was really something where I wouldn't want to go again, and that's why we're so keen on evaluating going straight through Mantra.
Yeah, because the artichoke, as you describe it, is kind of backlit, and so you do have some dark shadows. It's obviously quite contrasty because of the height, and yet those faint kind of wispy clouds that are in the foreground do give it a tremendous sense of scale. It's it's really beautiful imagery. You mentioned before a reference of Naboo or other, you know, Star Wars kind of type. Mm-hmm. Was that ever an explicit thing, or was that just something that you were thinking yourself?
No, that was what I was thinking about.
It does have that feel of a different world, doesn't it? I mean, it's a nice visual reference.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's this there are these two plasma reactors just before the artichoke fires its communication ray into the sky that start glowing from the inside. And I mean, those two reactors, or I don't know what you want to call them, but if they generate plasma energy, I guess you'd call them reactors. Those kind of reminded me in their shape of a couple of things as you said, Naboo, or even Hoth, the rebel base on Hoth in The Empire Strikes Back. So we were really flattered to be given such a chance to work on images as big as that. And like, as I might have said that to you some time earlier, it's rare that we as a German company get to work on science fiction images. So we're absolutely blown away to be given that chance.
Well, look, you guys have really earned the right to do this kind of stuff, because you do amazing work. Can I just swing around on the technical thing for a second, though? This was primarily shot on film, so you were matching this stuff into film plates?
True, yes. But that was, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because I really enjoy very much working on film, because at least you know what you have. You know, it's like with all the digital stuff, I mean, it's not only catching up, it's pretty much already the standard, so to say. But I mean, everyone's worked on film for at least two decades now. And digitally scanned film. And pretty much everyone knows how to handle standard Cineon format and how to white balance it and how to apply a color cube. And I mean, while the digital cameras are really very good by now in their digital imaging capabilities and in their sensors, sometimes, I say sometimes, not always, but sometimes the post workflow that the footage takes is not perfectly figured out. And you end up having something where you don't really know what color space you're looking at. And that makes compositing images really, really hard. So I was very happy to work on film.
Who did the scans? I mean, where did the film, like, what was the pipe that got it to you?
Ari did that. It was all based on German lab, Ari in Berlin, and they did a terrific job. I mean, the scanning process and the quality of the scans, the sharpness of the images, everything worked out really, really well. We also got their DI cube, of course, to see what they're seeing, and the whole color pipeline was really well figured out from the start. But I didn't expect anything else from Dan and Steph.
No, of course. So that was shot on Arri cameras. But when you said the color cubes for the pipeline back in terms of the 3D LUTs, who did the final grading? Like, where did the film, you know, when it left you, where did those shots go for final mastering?
To Arri as well. It was pretty much all, the whole post thing was all based at Arri.
And so that must have given you a lot of confidence just in terms of, you know, having that nice closed loop. But you still, of course, had to, you know, match in. And I guess in those cloud sequences, that extra film latitude must have really come in handy in terms of just really protecting the highlights and having lovely, deep, rich neg.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. No, it was... It was a blast to work on. The cube just did a really subtle, nice soft flip on top of that, and just gave you all the detail and the wispy little clouds, the backlit stuff, the way it glows and is illuminated from the inside. Just, yeah, we were already blown away with the moment we saw the raw helicopter plates and thought, like, oh god, yeah, just like to put some great architecture in. And It really is somewhat surreal. If it wouldn't have been that lighting atmosphere from the start, I think we would have had to invent it. It's a coincidence.
So look, we've only touched on a few of the shots you worked on, but I think you did over like 100 shots in final as Rise effects, right? In addition to the work that was done on the scanning, is that correct?
Yeah, true. We did. We were main vendor on the whole 70s episode in San Francisco with Halle Berry. We transformed Düsseldorf into San Francisco at night, for example, adding rails from cable cars and more vintage cars driving in the background. We also used a couple of vintage cars from our LiDAR scans that we just had. I mean, it's just it's not a big deal once you have the LiDAR scan to generate a really low resolution mesh, clean it a bit, apply a car paint shader and have a driver around somewhere in the far distance with headlights at night to illuminate the road. So, and that really gives everything scale, depth, and enough detail to sell the whole city idea. So as I said, like, we transformed Düsseldorf into San Francisco at night. There were a couple of pictures that Steph Soretti provided. I think a couple of friends of his at Evil Eye, they did a photo shoot in San Francisco from various locations that we picked on Google Street View. So reference, right? And they just went out with a big DSLR and took HDRs from various angles, shot quick times of moving cars in the background, uphill, downhill, everything you could ever possibly want. Perfect reference for the telegraph poles of the Glasgow streets, for example. And then there is a shot where we're looking downhill in Glasgow, where we are seeing the Oakland Bay Bridge in the background. we took that from the images that we got from San Francisco, and then took some cars from QuickTimes, rotoscoped them, and put them on the bridge so that you can see a couple of little dots moving on the bridge in the background, as well as the Transamerica Pyramid that's reflecting in the facade in the scene. That was really one of the brilliant ideas of Steph Soretti, because we had such a limited field of view standing on street level in the streets of Glasgow. You had like buildings on the left, you had buildings on the right, and that was pretty much already limiting the view of the bay in the distance. And we wanted to have this really, really wide, beautiful vista to sell it as San Francisco the first moment you see it. And so placing more skyscrapers that already existed in the 70s on screen would have been a real mess, because it just would have blocked your view of the Bay Area in the background. And then Steph came up with the brilliant idea of having the Transamerica Pyramid just reflect in the facade of one of the foreground buildings that were really there in Glasgow. So that when you just pay attention to all the details that are there, you'll see more of that, and just the Transamerica Pyramid as one of the signature sites of San Francisco was just a brilliant idea to have it as at one point, like it's prominent in frame, and at the same time it doesn't take up more screen space to show the bay and the bridge in the background and to show where we really are.
Well, look, people often criticize our industry for not taking risks and being very formulaic and just sort of redoing sequels and stuff again. So I want to applaud you and the filmmakers for really taking some risks. And I couldn't have been happier when I heard that I believe it was at the Toronto Film Festival that it got a 10-minute standing ovation when it was screened. So congratulations on the film and congratulations on your work. And as I say, that satellite dish sequence is just breathtakingly beautiful. So well done. I hope you get to do more science fiction work. So I'd like to see it.
Thank you very much, Mike. Yes, we like to work on more science fiction.
And thanks for taking time to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, thanks to Mike and to Florian for that. Before we close out, I'd like to thank our FX Insider members who support the site through their contributions. As a thanks for donations made as part of the FX Insider program, we give exclusive access to additional content, things like member-only articles, additional FX breakdowns, and more. Details are at fxguide.com. Click the FX Insider tab. In addition to the FX podcast you've been listening to, we do two other regular audio podcasts. The first is the VFX Show, which reviews visual effects in current releases as well as classic films. The RC podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography, and God knows it changes all the time. It's really hard to keep up with, but Jason and Mike will take you through all the changes as they occur. If you enjoyed this podcast, we'd also recommend our HD video podcast, FX Guide TV. And as I mentioned at the beginning, our sister site, fxphd.com, offers extensive, affordable online visual effects training. So this is Jeff Huser from my partners Mike Seymour and John Montgomery. We'll see you on the next FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.